Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're zooming in on something critical, the digital financial services sector right here in Southeast Asia, or as we often say, ASEAN. And look, this isn't just a broad overview. We're tailoring this specifically for you, the leaders, government officials, the policy shapers inside organizations who really need, well, actionable intelligence now. The whole region's digital economy is frankly booming. It's on track to blow past $300 billion in gross merchandise value. That kind of growth, it's not just numbers. It tells you people are getting more involved digitally. Things are maturing fast.
Absolutely. And if you just follow the money, I mean, it's crystal clear where the action is. Finance. The DFS sector, it's really become the center of gravity for growth. It's moved way beyond just basic payments now. It's pulling in something like 45 to 50% of all private funding over the last year. That's a huge jump, right? Used to be around 30%. So all this capital flowing in, it basically validates that the innovation is happening at, well, breakneck speed. For you as decision makers, this really means the policy choices you're making today, particularly around risk, around infrastructure, they're absolutely paramount for capturing value tomorrow.
Okay, so that sets up our mission for this deep dive then. How do governments, how do organizations regulate the strong growth we're seeing right now, you know, in lending, payments, while also designing the policy and the infrastructure needed for, let's face it, the huge impact AI is going to have on finance?
All right, let's start with the basics, the foundation. That's payments. And honestly, this is an area where policy has already scored some major wins. The whole digital payments ecosystem across the ASEAN 10, it's incredibly mature. We're looking at projected gross transaction value hitting, what, $1.4 trillion in 2025? And the key policy milestone, really, is standardizing QR codes. Think about it. All 10 CN countries now have their own national unified QR system. We just saw Myanmar launch MMQR and Brunei launch TARSQR this year. That completes the set. Regulators definitely saw the need for that kind of standardization early on.
And that standardization hasn't just stayed within borders, has it? It's gone cross-border, which for a region as diverse as CNN, that's arguably even more vital. So now we have 8 markets where you can use QR codes across borders, and that Regional Payment Connectivity Initiative, the RPC, that's a really critical piece of policy work. Mm-hmm. Cambodia just joined, making it 9 central banks signed up now. Why does this matter so much for leaders listening in? Well, this QR ubiquity, it's a direct policy win because it's fundamentally reshaping the market. It's really chipping away at that old cash is king idea. Cash is projected to drop to only about 38% of total GTV in 2025. And maybe even more importantly, shifting to these cheaper, often government-backed payment methods is pushing down the average merchant discount rate, or, you know, the fee vendors pay. It's dropping by about 0.05 percentage points every year. That's a real cost saving, a direct policy benefit for businesses.
Exactly. And that success in payments, it sort of clears the way for the rest of the financial ecosystem to mature. Lending is still the biggest slice of the revenue pie for DFS, looking like $22 billion in revenue projected for 2025. And digital lending is key here because it's actually reaching underserved people, often through like embedded loans right inside e-commerce apps or e-wallets. We're also seeing real scale emerging in digital wealth platforms. Several now have over $1 billion in assets under management. So consumers are definitely moving beyond just simple transactions.
Okay, but with maturity comes risk, right? So smart regulation becomes crucial. Let's talk about how policy is trying to adapt, especially with all this digital lending. We saw a really strong move in Indonesia, didn't we? The Financial Services Authority, OJK, they brought in a strict equity floor for the P2P lenders. And that was, well, a direct policy intervention aimed at shaking up the market structure. It basically forced consolidation, the outcome. Fewer lenders, but the ones left are much better capitalized.
Very stable.
Exactly, the government ensuring stability. At the same time, we're seeing new players pop up these digital banks. Look at Thailand and Malaysia. Their new virtual banks seem to be targeting niches like working capital loans for micro SMEs. So policy is also nudging competition in certain directions.
What's really interesting in all this is the reality of embedded finance. I mean, it's everywhere now, travel apps, food delivery, you name it. But here's the catch for policy shapers. Just because people use it doesn't mean they trust it or feel loyal to it.
Yeah, our sources are pretty clear on this. There's still a significant trust gap. Consumers, generally speaking, just don't trust these digital finance players as much as they trust their traditional bank. And there's a loyalty gap, too. Loads of people use multiple e-wallets, and many say their main e-wallet isn't actually their first port of call if they need credit. So if loyalty is that weak, does that maybe suggest regulators need to think about things like data portability? you know, make it easier for users to switch providers, spur more competition that way? Or is this lack of trust more fundamental, like a product quality issue the market itself needs to fix?
That's sort of the million-dollar question, isn't it? The data kind of suggests that when the finance part is almost invisible, it works better. Take embedded microinsurance sold through super apps. The opt-in rates are way higher than if you try to sell that same insurance product on its own.
Yeah.
So that implies the platforms themselves really need to focus on building these comprehensive, trusted ecosystems. Policy can help, maybe by setting data standards, but ultimately earning that trust, that falls on the platform providing a holistic service.
And we really can't talk about these internal policy challenges without glancing at the bigger picture. There's the whole context now of new U.S. tariffs, which are leading to downward revisions in GDP growth forecasts for export-heavy places like Vietnam and Cambodia.
Mm-hmm. That external pressure.
Right. That global uncertainty just makes strong internal policy even more critical, doesn't it? Building resilient stability, strong capital standards within the DFS center, it's absolutely vital right now.
Okay, so we've sketched out the current playbook, standardized payments, managed lending risk. But if today's big challenge is, say, P2P stability, the challenge for the next decade feels completely different. It's this idea of the intelligent economy. We need to shift gears a bit from just reacting to current risks to actually designing the guardrails for AI.
Yeah, absolutely. The speed at which AI is being adopted across CTone is remarkable. And it throws up, I think, three really unique dynamics that policymakers need to tackle, like right now. First is what I call the ROI challenge. Think about the big AI models, the LLMs. They're mostly developed in high-wage economies, right? The U.S., Europe. Now, compare that to CERN, where average wages are maybe only 5% of U.S. wages. Suddenly, the return on investment for using AI for full automation, actually replacing human workers, it looks, well, pretty difficult to justify economically. But hang on, is that difficulty in scaling AI's ROI here, actually, helpful for policy shapers? I mean, if the business case for replacing lots of workers is weak, doesn't that give regulators some breathing room? Time to focus policy less on mitigating mass job losses and more on enabling AI for, say, workforce augmentation, helping people do higher value work.
That's a great point. Yes, it absolutely reframes the policy task. It shifts it from being purely defensive to more of an enablement strategy. How do we use this tech to create more value? Which leads to the second dynamic, regulatory fragmentation. This patchwork of different rules across the 10 ASEAN countries, especially around data privacy and data usage, creates real friction. You have data localization laws, notably in Indonesia and Thailand, which restrict cross-border data flows. But those flows are pretty crucial for training sophisticated AI. We really need more harmonization on data standards to unlock that regional potential.
Okay, ROI challenge, regulatory fragmentation. And the third dynamic, you called it the policy wildcard, agentic transactions.
Right. This is really looking further out, but it's where things are headed. Imagine AI agent software carrying out secure financial tasks completely on their own. No human clicking buttons. But for that to work, we need a whole new policy foundation built on fixing basically three big infrastructure gaps. First is digital identity. If an AI agent is going to act for you, it needs a reliable, verifiable digital ID. This avoids endless KYC checks. We need standardization across CN nations here. Maybe something like Singapore SingPass could be a model. We need consistent coverage. Second gap, interoperability. These agents have to work across different platforms seamlessly. Let's say your AI books your travel and needs to pay instantly on some regional booking site. It needs standard APIs, shared infrastructure, so it can make that payment smoothly, regardless of which bank or e-wallet is behind the scenes.
Right. And the final piece you mentioned is the payment infrastructure itself. Because globally, when people talk about agentic payments, they often default to thinking about card networks. But Sihun, as we've said, runs heavily on QR codes and e-wallets.
Exactly. Cards are actually less than 10% of the gross transaction value in major markets like Indonesia, Cambodia, Myanmar, Laos. So policy support here needs to be innovative and tailored locally. We need to prioritize developing agentic-ready QR infrastructure. We have to make sure our own homegrown payment systems can handle these complex, autonomous AI transactions down the line. So when you put it all together, the strategic job for leaders listening becomes pretty clear. You're essentially managing two tracks at once. Track one. Keep managing the current growth momentum, stabilize lending, standardize payments further. Track two, actively enable the coming intelligent economy by investing in that future infrastructure and getting ahead on AI governance.
It's a massive challenge, no doubt. But the potential payoff is equally massive. I mean, we saw the digital economy in the region grow from maybe $40 billion just a decade ago to where it is now. And our sources really hammer this point home. The success over the next decade, it won't just be about the tech itself. It's going to be defined by, and I quote, the wild card of regulatory choices. Those choices could either unlock or, frankly, inhibit the region's incredible potential.
And maybe that leaves you, the listener, with one final thought to chew on. This AI technology, it's not some far-off future thing in terms of operations. It's already here. Something like 64% of investors are already reporting cost savings from integrating AI. So policy can't just be about managing risk, about being cautious. It really has to focus on how to maximize the huge value creation potential of AI for the digital economy, especially making sure those benefits reach the underserved segments. You know, and doing that without getting bogged down by regulatory inertia.
Definitely food for thought as you navigate the next wave of policy decisions across CNU. We really hope these insights help you apply both precision and foresight to the incredible opportunity that lies ahead.